I'm J.R. Jameson. Today on The Facing Project, my guests are Colonel Briefram and Dr. Liz Cavallaro, authors of the new book, Forging Queer Leaders, How the LGBTQIA+ Community Creates Impact from Adversity. And we're going to get a bit nerdy on you and do what I love most, which is marrying storytelling to statistics and developmental theories. Oh, I know, get excited, but I promise you this won't be boring. You won't want to miss this conversation. We'll explore crucible moments such as coming out and code switching and how these types of experiences propel LGBTQIA+ individuals into being better leaders. We'll dive deep into examples of action from some of the 100 LGBTQIA+ leaders interviewed for their book, who represent multiple sectors such as business, academia, nonprofits, medicine, entertainment, and government services. And we'll talk about implications for organizations to create safer and welcoming environments. Stay with us. You're listening to The Facing Project with J.R. Jameson, and my guests are Colonel Briefram and Dr. Liz Cavallaro, authors of the new book, Forging Queer Leaders, How the LGBTQIA+ Community Creates Impact from Adversity. And in our conversation today, we'll explore crucible moments, such as coming out and code switching, and how these propel LGBTQIA+ individuals into being better leaders. We'll look at examples in action, and also how organizations can create safer and welcoming environments for all employees to thrive. Colonel Briefram and Dr. Liz Cavallaro, authors of Forging Queer Leaders, How the LGBTQIA+ Community Creates Impact from Adversity. Thank you for joining me on The Facing Project.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, it's our pleasure to be here.
I want to say it was such a joy to me to be able to read Forging Queer Leaders and to get to know the two of you, and also the stories of so many queer leaders you shared in the book. It's a true testament to the power of resilience and the strength and courage LGBTQIA+ individuals bring to organizations and to society. Take me back to the genesis. Why did you decide to write the story?
Well, this is Bree, and for me, this was an intensely personal thing, because as a transgender service member, this has been my journey as much as anything else to figure out, what does it look like to be a leader in this community and to understand leadership development? And along the way, I was lucky enough to get a chance to attend the Naval War College, and I got into a program where Liz was one of my professors. And in that course, we had to do a lengthy paper. So I wanted to write about leadership development among minorities in the military. And there was so much there. And throughout it, I had the opportunity to say, I'd like to do more on this, but I don't want to do it alone. And so I sent Liz a note as we were wrapping things up and said, would you like to write a book with me?
Wow. And Liz, how did you respond?
I said yes, and that was the second time that I made the really smart decision of saying yes to Bree's request. First was earlier in the year when the students had to propose their research paper topic, and as one of the faculty members in the program, I had the opportunity to offer up my services as advisor. And I wrote to her and said, you know, if you want the person with the deepest subject matter expertise on the theories that you're going to write about, that's probably not me. And do you want the person who is going to give you the best guidance on writing a really highly rigorous quality academic paper, that's definitely not me. But if you want the person with the most passion for this, it's absolutely me. So please let me be your advisor. And luckily for me, she said yes to that.
So I imagine both of you have written many academic papers and perhaps published in academic journals. Was this a first book for the two of you?
It was the first book for the two of us together, and I believe Liz's first book overall. She's probably a far more published academic. I fall more on the practitioner side of things. Though I've written before, written extensively, this was an opportunity to do something a little bit different. So it was a lot of fun to come together and kind of meld that academic background and that rigor and that field of study that Liz has had, some of my personal experiences, but then even more so, the experiences of our contributors. And how do we pull that all together in a way that melds theory, and as we say in the book, puts the scaffolding around these stories that allow you to construct this view of queer leadership development?
Yeah, this is Liz, and I had certainly had the opportunity to do scholarly journal articles and empirical research. And while I am a qualitative researcher and I get the opportunity to work with people when I do research academically, this was so much more fun and exciting because not only were we working with the people, but we got to really tell their stories in a more robust and comprehensive way. We got to dig deeper into it and put a little bit more of each person's journey into the book. And so that storytelling aspect was very new for me to be able to write a book like this. And that part of it was really fun and exciting.
That's what I love so much about the book. It was a good marrying of qualitative and quantitative research, the mixed methods approach, but done so in such a strong storytelling way. In the book, you talk about crucible moments and vertical development as transformational opportunities for LGBTQIA plus individuals. Talk more about these two terms and their potential.
Sure. So this is Liz again. Vertical development is an area that I study, and it's basically about people being able to expand their capacity, their cognitive capacity, their emotional capacity, the space that they have to grapple with the challenges that we face, especially that leaders face when they're operating in complex environments. And so one of the easiest ways to understand what we mean by vertical development is actually to understand its counterpart, which is called horizontal development. And usually when we talk about professional development or training or education, the things that come to most people's minds are the gaining of skills, the gaining of tools or competencies. And we refer to that as filling a person's cup. So you fill your cup with tools, skills, information. And this competency building is, of course, something that's very important for most professional journeys. And it's necessary, but not necessarily sufficient for the complexity that we faced. So in order to face some of those challenges, we need essentially a bigger cup. So not only are we filling the cup with competencies, but we're expanding the size of the cup so that we have greater capacity for what we do with all of those tools and skills. And that allows us to operate more effectively when we are facing unprecedented or emergent challenges, when the situation that we're encountering has a lot of interdependent variables and may be very complex and difficult to comprehend. It allows us to see more and to do more with the tools that we have. So that's what vertical development is all about. And we know that one of the ways that that happens is that people experience that transformation by facing challenges that are a bit more complex than perhaps what they're currently ready to tackle. And in doing that, particularly in facing, for example, a crucible moment, we can expand ourselves in this way. And when we say crucible, we're talking about something that the experience we have is so substantial that we cannot possibly and will not be the same on the other side as we were before. So that transformation actually occurs. And then hopefully on the other side of that, we've developed a greater capacity to deal with those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. You all really took me back to my grad school days as I was reading the book. And I was fascinated by the complex stages of cognitive capacity and Robert Keegan's research on mental complexity theory, whereby there are four stages individuals move through as they develop: self-sovereign, socialized, self-authoring, and self-transformational. But most adults, roughly 60%, never move beyond the socialized stage. Tell me more about this and how it all connects.
Sure. Yeah. So this theory is one of multiple different frameworks that puts some emphasis on the differentiation between different stages we might evolve through in our vertical development journey. And I say might because it's not a given. It's not definite that we will continue evolving what is known as the socialized stage, which is essentially what we think of as where we're trying to get to as adults so that we can contribute to society, that we can be functioning, productive members of our various groups and organizations. We can sort of follow the rules and adhere to group norms and expectations. And we have that membership in our various groups that we're a part of, and that gives us our identity. And it gives us a way to know who we are, how to operate in the world, how to navigate the challenges that we face. And so if we think, for example, of childhood development, we're basically trying to get kids and young adults into this place where they are socialized into our social norms so that they can operate effectively in those environments. And most adults will at some point achieve that level. And for many adults, the environments that they're operating in and the types of challenges that they face align pretty well with that. They match up with what a person at a socialized stage of mind is able to do. And therefore, there isn't necessarily an impetus or a motivation to need to grow beyond that. But for others who operate in much more complex environments, the demands that they're encountering potentially do require something beyond that, something that's a bit more mentally complex, more sophisticated and nuanced in how they think and make sense of the world, something that gives them a broader scope and perspective. And as we were talking about with vertical development, a bigger cup, greater capacity for how they tackle challenges and use the skills and tools that they have. And so these stages that exist beyond this, the next one is called self-authored, and then the one beyond self-transforming, they're increasingly sophisticated levels of cognitive capacity. And so that is something that we looked at in the book. And I'll let Bree share why, when learning about this particular theory in the program that she was in, she observed that there might be something there and that there might be a link to the minority and in particular LGBTQ experience and journey.
Yeah, this is a critical feature in how we think LGBTQ folks kind of get a leg up on this cognitive developmental journey. Because for most adults in that socialized mind state, you're comfortable. And you've experienced a world where society has told you who you are, and you look at yourself and say, yes, that's me. But for LGBTQ individuals, society may look at you and tell you, this is who you should love, or this is who you are, and you have to do that internalized work despite society's expectations and say, no, this is who I am. And that is almost by definition that move from the socialized mind to the self-authoring stage. You have set a standard that is yours alone and are standing up for it despite what society is saying. And so that coming out experience is such a foundational moment because it involves that introspective look and that defining of self. And I like to think, in many cases, perhaps I'm biased, that trans people often have the potential to go even further with the coming out and transition process, that ability to see the world from multiple perspectives that is so critical to not only the self-authoring stage, but the transformational stage beyond that. And as we heard this echoed through so many of the stories that our contributors shared with us, it really reinforced how strongly we felt about that self-identification, that work that is done to define yourself, being so critical to leading in complex contexts.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to a point you just made. As I was reading the testimonials in the book from trans and non-binary individuals, I kept thinking, perhaps their experiences have the ability to push them through all four stages of Keegan's mental complexity theory, and ultimately, they might make the best leaders of all. Tell us more about that. What do you say to that?
I think there's a lot of potential there. Now, we do call these and refer to them as crucible moments because they are really trying. These are difficult, challenging circumstances. And it takes work to come out on the other side differently. It is not, you just go through that and now you're great and you're amazing. So that reflection has to continue to occur after those moments. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people that don't survive the crucible in a positive way. They may actually choose to retreat instead. So it's a really difficult moment to come through, do that introspection, do that reflection, and continue to grow. But if you do, what I think this offers members of our community is more chances to grow, to thrive. But some people see those, as I said, and either retreat or run from it in even a more severe circumstance, because it's tough. Mm-hmm. It is very difficult and can be ostracizing at times to stand up to society's views of who you should be.
Mm-hmm. If someone retreats, looking at the opposite end of the leadership spectrum, is there some moving backward in leadership development as well?
It's certainly possible that there's a regression that can occur if someone is facing circumstances that are not enabling and empowering them to be their full self or to continue that development journey, or even worse, circumstances that are actually dangerous or threatening to be able to be one's authentic self. Mm-hmm. And so we may retreat back into ourselves. And in that space, it's likely that we're not going to be able to identify and then leverage those opportunities that we have to become fortified as a result of our struggles. Instead, we're just clearly focusing on surviving those experiences. And so that can certainly occur. And where we see some of that are examples that some of the leaders we spoke to told us about earlier on in their journeys, before they had come to this place of both self-realization, self-authoring their own story and their own book, to then be able to feed that forward into their leadership and lead as their authentic self, and all of these additional superpowers that we think come with that, which I'm sure we'll chat about. But what we heard was earlier on in the journeys, before those things had happened, or when they were in environments that were not welcoming or even dangerous, that inability to show up as one's full self, and oftentimes that necessity to hide, resulted in being significantly less connected to the people that they worked with, to the organizations that they were a part of. And it also results in a lot of additional labor. This is something else that Robert Keegan writes about, which is the way in which everyone at work often has a second job that they're doing that no one is paying them for. Mm-hmm. And that second job, and this is something that all people do, it's that impression management, right? It's focusing on your image and demeanor and what other people are going to be observing about you, being cautious about what you do and don't share about yourself and who you are. And we all do a little bit of that. It is natural. But for folks who are forced to do that because something about them doesn't meet societal norms and expectations, or even worse, because they're going to face bias and discrimination or even danger if they do bring that full self to work, for those folks, they are significantly spending a ton of energy on that extra labor. And when they can stop doing that, or at least do significantly less of that, that untapped potential that was there suddenly explodes. And so we heard so many stories that took us through that journey and showed us the before and the after, and how much more leadership capacity they had when they got to the other side of that.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about people retracting or going backward, that's really about safety. It's about not feeling comfortable in environments, right? And so one piece that you talk about in the book is providing safe and welcoming environments for employees so they can thrive and become the best leaders in the organization. And you talk about how this is done through crucible moments, right? And finding their leadership skills that they can tap into these moments they've gone through. You interviewed over 100 LGBTQIA plus leaders who are making real change and getting stuff done across businesses, academia, nonprofits, medicine, entertainment, and government services. Every story was unique, but the parallels were really similar in many ways about their lived experiences, such as being in the closet and coming out of the closet, right? I want to focus on code switching that you talk about in the book, and this ability to read a room and respond accordingly that so many of us in the LGBTQIA plus community have to do every day in every environment that we walk into. How does this translate into a leadership superpower?
But this is a great example of those skills that have both a negative consequence, but in a different setting or different context can be these amazing leadership superpowers. So just as Liz talked extensively about identity management, LGBTQ folks do that all the time. When you walk into a room and you have to assess the situation, understand, is it safe to be me here? Am I going to come out 17 times over the course of this evening in casual conversation? Am I forcing it by something that I'm wearing that explains who I am to everyone that I meet? Or am I going to hide that? Am I going to act as society expects me to act in this situation? So what it really forces you to do is understand the context and communicate in a way that is designed for that environment. So if you're doing that to protect yourself, that can be exceptionally draining. I like to use the great example from my fandom passion of Star Trek and saying, that's walking into a room and saying, full power to the shields, mm-hmm. you know, and because I'm going to walk through this room in this dinner party, whatever it is, protecting myself. But if instead I can take that energy that I would have put into my shields and put that into the conversations that I have with other people, with listening, with understanding, and build my relationships, that's where it's really valuable, because everything that I used to read the room to protect myself can now be used to read, what is this person feeling? How are they reacting? How can I change my message or what I'm saying to get them to where I want them to go? And that's leadership. It's providing that influence to a group of people to get them to go in a common direction. And you have to be able to get feedback and to read others in order to do that. Mm-hmm.
Which brings me to empathy, which stuck out as well in the stories that you shared. LGBTQIA plus leaders seem to have a higher sense of empathy for employees, for everything that we just talked about. What does that look like in action? And does it differ depending on sector?
I think it certainly will differ in terms of perhaps the nature of the kinds of relationships you're able to develop or the depth of the engagements you can have with people. But I think what we found to be fairly universal in these leaders' stories is that natural instinct to understand everybody's got stuff, right? In that very sophisticated way of saying it, right? We are all experiencing things. We're all going through things. And many of those things are going to be things that are opaque to others, whether that be intentional because someone feels they're not able to bring that forward, or whether that just be because it's an aspect of their life that isn't necessarily known in a workplace context. And so because these leaders have had so many of those experiences themselves, and they know so intimately what it feels like and what they are losing in terms of their ability to come forward, they've lived through that, and therefore they are highly cognizant of the fact that others may be as well. And so they have this interest in understanding what others are going through. They have this knowledge and awareness that there's probably something, mm-hmm. even if I don't know about it yet. And then they also have the genuine care and concern that they have developed around understanding how challenging things can be. And therefore, the other things that other people are going through, even if they in no way resemble the same kinds of difficulties that the individual has faced, the nature of having something under the surface that you're grappling with that's causing you challenge or even pain, that natural empathy is just so tuned into that and so perceptive to that, that when they then are able to make that connection, they are able to provide the support that is needed. And the interesting flip side, and this was the part that I found really fascinating, is that not only is the empathy there and being directed outward so that they are ready and available to help people when needed, but the way others perceive these leaders because of their authenticity, because they are sharing their own struggles and the journeys that they've been through, that often makes people more likely to come to them, to choose that leader as the person that they might open up to, even if they haven't otherwise felt that they're able to. And so the opportunity is more likely to arise because the person might be more willing and the leader is more perceptive and ready to help however they can.
Mm-hmm. There was a good testimonial that you shared in the book that was just an aha that happens every day in every office, right? An employee is running late to work. And instead of saying, why are you late? Or asking a confrontational question, someone who has gone through these experiences leading with empathy would ask the question, is everything okay? And I thought that's just such a human thing and a common thing that happens every day. That just really stuck out to me. I want to go back to something too, Bree, that you were sharing about the shield. And I want to talk a bit about also just kind of naming too, the obvious in some ways in the room, right? There was, I believe, a congresswoman or senator, correct me if I'm wrong, who you shared her testimonial in the book. And when she was running, she was transitioning and she was worried about her voice. And she said in front of this group, basically, I'm going to name the obvious, right? And said it, put it out there and moved on. Could you both maybe, or one of you share more about what that means to just name something up front and then lead with confidence?
Yeah, absolutely. And you were referring to Breonna Tatone, who is a state senator in Colorado in their legislature. And she tells a great story about just putting herself out there right front. Look, I'm a trans person, but that's not what's important here. What's important is your lives and how we address the challenges that all of you who might be my constituents are facing. But it wasn't anything to hide. It wasn't anything to be ashamed of. It just wasn't relevant in that particular context. Mm-hmm. However, when we share that aspect of ourselves, when we share that authenticity, that's often what gets reflected back to us. Our authenticity, our vulnerability opens up those pathways for communication that Liz was just talking about, because almost all leaders have some degree of empathy, and most want to use it. But if they're not getting that feedback from the people around them about what their challenges are, or they don't have the relationship built where they even have the opportunity to use their empathy, that's a problem. So by putting that yourself really out there in a way that shows off who you authentically are, including some of your own flaws or challenges, can be really important to opening up that avenue that allows you to communicate with others in truly meaningful ways, mm-hmm. to engage your empathy at that point, and then better yet, solve your challenges together.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine provides the opportunity for employees or those who you're working with to lead to be more authentic themselves and more vulnerable, right, in that workspace as you're working as a team.
Yeah, and I'll share one more example. Prior to me transitioning, I thought I had been projecting an open and welcoming environment, that I wanted to understand what was going on. But it turns out I had been walking around with my shields up. Someone actually referred to me as Captain America, literally just with a shield in front of me. You know, I'm invulnerable, I'm perfect. And somehow my message was, I don't care because I'm so great. And I'm like, nothing was even close to the truth about that comment. But that wasn't what a lot of my people were receiving. Mm. And when I transitioned and I shared some of who I was and the challenges that I had faced and gone through, some of my own vulnerability, that wasn't my weakness, that was my avenue for connection. And after that, not only were my blinders removed to a whole host of things, but my folks started bringing me their problems. And that was amazing. For me as a commander in that situation, if I didn't know about the problems, I couldn't help solve them. But they opened up to me about so many more things, because all of a sudden it seemed like I cared. And I did before and I did after, But there was a mismatch in what I was projecting to the world. And it was just so heartwarming that we were able to solve some really difficult, both professional and personal issues that came up after that.
That's wonderful. I'm curious to know, too, about leaders with intersectional identities. For instance, if someone identifies as LGBTQIA+, and also maybe Black or Brown, do they experience a higher frequency of crucible moments and deeper vertical development, and thus have the ability to transform these experiences into stronger leadership qualities?
We heard a lot of interesting stories where intersectional identities were so important to the way in which the development journey unfolded. And so certainly it is very likely that the more marginalized identities a person have, the more crucible experiences or, you know, experiences of facing bias or marginalization are going to occur for them. But what is also interesting is the way in which an additional skill set, in addition to all of the other ones that these folks tend to develop, comes about in having to maybe even read and perceive the room even more acutely, because you're unpacking and disentangling all of the different kinds of biases and reactions that people might be having, and understanding which one of my identities is the one that is causing a problem here, is the one that people are struggling with, or which one of my identities is the one that I can actually tap into and leverage and make a connection on. And that ability to tap into something about yourself, something that you have experienced, something that is a part of your identity that will actually help you connect with different audiences, was another skill set that we saw across all of these leaders. But then with these folks with intersectional identities, there was really this additional, again, disentangling that they needed to do to then figure out and do that analysis of which one of these identities do I need to address, whether because there's a friction occurring or whether because there's something that I can actually lean into and have some benefit occur.
Mm-hmm. Lorena Soto's example in the book is so fabulous. For her, as a doctor, she was learning some techniques in surgery, and she couldn't figure out why this person just didn't seem to like her. And she had to kind of list them off. Is it because I'm a woman? Is it because I'm gay? Is it because I'm Puerto Rican? Or is it because I'm left-handed, which is apparently a big deal to surgeons? And it took that navigating of multiple identities. I believe in this example, it turned out he just didn't like women. But it's that, as you mentioned, these multiple crucibles, these many opportunities for people to experience that discrimination or those societal views that allows them to reflect and transform and grow. Unfortunately, that also means many more opportunities for pain and for hurt to come along. But if you get through those again, you can just have these incredible leaders. So our queer people of color with other marginalized identities, if they survive the challenges they faced, wow, watch out, world, because they are going to do some incredible things.
Mm-hmm. I loved how you both talked in the book about trans leaders and how trans women, right, see how women are treated in the workplace after they transition and experience a whole new right thing, and how trans men see the privilege that men carry in the workplace after they transition. Can you talk more about this?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting look at, we mentioned earlier how you gain those multiple perspectives and you can start seeing situations from more than one angle yourself. And that's really valuable in itself, but it also opens you up to the perspectives of others and wanting to welcome those in and building better solutions because of it. My personal example in that was, for the majority of my life, I would walk down a dark alley in a busy street, not thinking a thing about it. And then all of a sudden, like, I don't know if this is safe for me. And having to do that sort of cognitive gymnastics and reimagine my view of myself in the world and what is okay actually would then translate to my thinking processes in other situations where am I thinking about this in the right way? If I was in a different set of circumstances or was another person, how would I think about this situation differently? So I think it's valuable to ourselves in our ability to see things differently, understand what others might be experiencing, whether that's from a privilege perspective or just a problem-solving perspective, and then integrate that with not just ourselves, but with the others around us.
Mm-hmm. We've talked some about regression and the dangers of crucible moments, and that they don't always translate into rosy or becoming supercharged, especially for those in the LGBTQI plus community. Can you talk a bit more about this and the importance of maintaining energy and also building community?
Some of the other stories that we heard, as I mentioned earlier, kind of earlier in certain folks' journeys, every negative impact that you can imagine of having faced bias and marginalization, and the period of time, however long it lasts in someone's life, where they are unable to be themselves and they are not safe to bring their whole self into the world, is really, really dangerous for a variety of reasons. But when it comes to this cognitive development concept, in order to develop, it's not just going through a really challenging crucible experience and then growing from it and being fortified on the other side. There's a lot of intentionality and deliberateness and willingness that has to exist. So individuals, in order for the challenges that they face to cause development in a positive way, they have to have a mindset and an attitude that is open and vulnerable and willing to learn and grow and have that intellectual humility and growth mindset. So they need to be coming into the experiences they have, good, bad, or otherwise, with a willingness to learn and grow. And so that personal ability to do that and willingness to go through the discomfort that is associated with this kind of growth, it takes a lot. It takes courage. It takes that energy, and it takes being open to the parts of it that won't be all that pleasant. And so for folks who are in situations where all they can do is put that energy into survival and protecting themselves, there's just not going to be any space left. There's not going to be any energy left over to do the hard work of development, to do the introspection and reflection and deep, thoughtful analysis of one's own identity and place in the world. It takes a lot of work. And so for folks who went through periods of time where the demands upon them were basically just about survival, in those periods of time, it was very, very hard, if not impossible, to essentially be working on the self.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the community aspect comes in, of it's so important for so many queer folks to have that found family or that LGBT community that they are part of that gives them life, that gives them joy, that gives them that energy, that support that might be necessary in these situations to keep going, to push through some of these very challenging moments, and to develop that sense of, we're in this together. We've got you. That is incredibly important.
Mm-hmm. If a non-LGBTQIA plus leader is listening to this and they're thinking, how do I create a better home for my employees or potential future leaders? What does that look like? What do you say to them? How do they create an environment that helps those folks find strength in their crucible moments?
This is a great question about how do we truly create cultures of inclusion, because they're valuable for everyone, regardless of whether your people are all members of the LGBT community or none of them are. There's someone in there that probably feels somewhat excluded. And we have to, as leaders, make sure that everyone's ideas are welcome, that everyone is getting the support that they need. And this takes work on our part as leaders to understand what it is that motivates any of our people, because it's going to be different. Some people want monetary rewards. Some people want public praise. Some people want time off. There could be any number of things that really tell a person, you are valued here. Your contributions are valued here. So leaders need to do that active questioning sometimes if they haven't picked it up in other ways to find out what it is that works for you as an individual. The collective isn't always going to respond to the same things. But if we figure out those little levers that work for people, that can go an incredibly long way in creating a culture where everyone feels valued. I talk about this a lot too. It's not about applying the golden rule and treating everyone like I want to be treating. It's about treating them like they want to be treated. And if we can figure that out, wow, we're going to see some really high performing teams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something that I learned from our contributors on this in terms of how to create better, more effective allyship is that allyship is active and it's out loud. It needs to be visible. And so it's one thing to have the best of intentions. It's another to put yourself out there as an ally. Certainly incredibly important for leaders, but for anyone in an organization or in any membership group to be visible in your support and allyship, to make sure both that the people who are members of the community know that you are a supporter, a safe person to talk to, someone that they can rely on, but also so that everyone else knows what is acceptable, what is appropriate, what the norms and expectations of our organization are for inclusion and belonging for all people. And so making that allyship very, very visible and having the courage at times in uncomfortable circumstances to speak up and to articulate very clearly what is and is not acceptable in your organization. So those pieces of allyship, so many of our folks shared examples of folks that they had worked with who had done that for them, or unfortunately the examples of the opposite. And I learned a lot about how to be a better ally from them.
Mm-hmm. Any words of caution for people who are trying to be a better ally? You talk a bit in the book about not putting the tax back on the LGBTQI plus community or any marginalized community, right? Talk more about this and maybe some of the words of caution for people who are trying to be better allies.
Yeah, this is a great question. And what I think we like to tell people is, as you mentioned, don't put the onus on the individual. And more importantly, don't ask questions merely to satisfy your own curiosity. Mm-hmm. If you are asking someone questions about their identity or who they are, it needs to be in service of building the relationship with that person. You never ask someone on the street about what's in their pants or who they love for any given topic or chance where you're just, you feel like you're intruding into someone's personal life. But if you're doing it because this is important for my relationship with you and the job that we've been given, and in my role as a leader to help develop you, then those questions are okay. But if you're curious about something that you don't know about, whether that's trans identities or anything wider about the LGBTQ community, get a book from the library, look it up on the internet, check a couple sources if you're doing it that way. But do that initial research yourself so you don't put that burden on the individual and you're not just asking because, oh my God, you're someone who might know. Do that work yourself as a leader and it'll be very valuable for you.
Mm-hmm. Several of the contributors actually just gave the example of one of the best questions people asked them was, what would you like me to know? And it's so simple, right? But just to give you a really tangible thing that you can use, that's a question, right? And that's not about satisfying one's own curiosity. And it's certainly not prying. It is showing I'm here to support. I'm interested because I'm interested in helping you. And I'll take in whatever information you want me to know that will enable me to provide you that support. And so that's a really easy one.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a bit about pathways to senior leadership. As we look across sectors, are there any sectors where perhaps this is being done really well, where folks who are LGBTQIA+, who have gone through these crucible moments, are sharing strong leadership qualities, are being promoted to senior leadership positions versus others? Or are we still seeing that there are certain sectors that are dominated by cisgender white individuals?
I don't think our research and our interviews pointed to any given sector where this is more or less of a challenge than anywhere else. I know there are a number of organizations out there that are focused on LGBTQ representation on things like corporate boards and senior management positions. And their reports say that the numbers are still dismal across the board on those things, where, you know, you're talking about 1-3% of board seats are being filled by LGBTQ members, even for organizations that say that is a goal of theirs to increase representation. So we're still seeing a struggle, but we're seeing generational change. And I think we're going to get there, again, across the board, but it's going to continue to be a fight. We're not going to flip a switch and say marginalized identities are in a great spot 5 years from now. It's going to be a continual struggle. Layla McKay wrote a book about the rainbow ceiling that says there a lot of this stuff too. There's kind of a cap almost at the very senior levels when you get up there, and that is still really difficult to break through. But we, through our book, our research, and our interviews, want to show that these are the people you want in those positions, because mm-hmm. they are the transformational leaders that can take your organization to that next level because of their superpowers that allow them to really get the most out of your teams.
Mm-hmm. And I think you make that case really well in the book. So well done on that. Forging Queer Leaders came out last year, and my mind keeps coming to the present and how quickly things can change. You note in the book that according to the 2020 census, 8% of American adults are LGBTQIA+, and that a 2021 report by the Human Rights Campaign aggregated government data to conclude that at least 20 million American adults could be LGBTQIA+. This is increase from years past as a shift in culture, but it's because folks are feeling more comfortable and safe to come out, which you talk about so eloquently in the book. Do you think this visibility could change under another Trump presidency? And what should we be worried about? And are there opportunities that exist?
I think the numbers go even beyond that. From when we published, you even more recently had a survey that said up to 30% of Gen Z adults identify as members of the LGBTQ community. It is hard to imagine that many people going back into the closet or hiding who they are. And that's why I think the answer really is long term. Will things be challenging over the next several years for members of the LGBTQ community? Without a doubt. And we don't know all the things that might occur or what that might mean for any individual circumstance. But as we talked about already, and Liz extensively covered the fact that sometimes people do need to retreat and hide themselves for matters of safety. And that's a very individual circumstance. We don't want to see that happen. It's devastating to hear the stories of the moments where that happens. And it's possible those circumstances will increase in the short term. But I remain incredibly hopeful with this cohort of young people that not only do they know a gay person or a queer person, they know 8, and 4 of them are probably their friends, and they probably know at least 1 or 2 trans people as well. That makes a huge difference in where we go in the far future, and I'm super excited about where we're going to get to, even if there are some very concerning near-term trends that may have huge impact on individuals' lives.
Mm-hmm. The youth will lead the way. I definitely believe that. And you can't put something back into a box. What advice would you have for employers or senior leaders of different sectors to make sure they maintain a welcoming and inclusive environment in what could be uncertain times for the LGBTQI plus community?
I think that goes back to the conversation around visibility, right? And so making sure that this is made publicly known that it is their intention to make sure to sustain positive momentum and to continue to protect and enable and support these folks inside of their organizations and communities. And so the first step certainly would be to make that known. And then, of course, to follow it up with action, to back up those words with actual deliberate activities that are going to continue to support and build on that momentum. And it will take different effort in different sectors, I think, right? It's obviously, as we think about the next 4 years and the potential for certain policies, laws, regulations, right? Depending on the industry that one works in, those things may be more or less likely to affect the people who work for you. So being really sensitive to that and understanding as these things unfold what the implications might be for different people in your organization and knowing how that could impact them and being aware that you may have some of these folks in your organization and that you don't know what their specific identity or circumstances are. So being kind of all encompassing about making sure that you are aware and prepared to respond to changes that might occur that might have implications for folks, whether you know that they're on your team or not.
Mm-hmm. And allyship is so much about action, but it's also absolutely crucial to be an ally when it matters the most. You don't want fair weather allies. If you abandon your allyship when pressure comes, that is a very clear signal that you are not firm in your values and you never really were. And those are the signals that if there's a pressure campaign against a company to drop a program of support for LGBTQ folks and they give in, even with what Liz says, knowing that they have a ton of LGBTQ people among both their employees and almost certainly their customers, what does that say? What does that mean for their talent base that they have access to? If they drop their allyship when it matters the most, they are going to lose critical people and lose access to people like them in the future who may have joined their company and made it stronger.
Mm-hmm. Lastly, I want to talk a bit about listening. The work we do here at the Facing Project is to create a more understanding and empathetic world. And your mission and ours is the same in that we believe this is done through storytelling and active listening. I'd love for both of you to add your perspectives on a question I'm asking all of my guests this season. How does one become a better and more authentic listener, particularly with individuals whose views differ from our own?
So I'll start off because I am bad at this. I have a narrative going in my head that always makes me want to respond or think about how I'm responding or will respond. What's the quippiest, most fascinating thing I could possibly say next? And it is active work to shut off that voice and just listen. So I think in my case, and I'm guessing in many others, it's about just giving yourself that reminder that it's not about me in this situation. Mm-hmm. I am listening to you, and I need to listen to understand you, not to respond to you. We'll get to that part. But first, I need to see where you're coming from. And I think for our queer leaders, that's kind of built into the process. I want to understand where you're coming from. I realize you have a different perspective than I do, and it's valuable. I want to hear it and understand it.
Mm-hmm. I think to lend to that, part of what helps you enter into a conversation with that perspective of, I think it's actually valuable what you have to say, and I want to genuinely understand it, is that it has to actually be genuine, meaning you need to be entering the conversation with a curiosity, a genuine interest and wonder in what the person thinks and how they've come to what they think. And it's almost, you know, this is something that's difficult for all of us. And that ability to remove yourself that Bree was talking about, to not be, you know, focused on your perspective and or focused on the response that you want to give. There's an expression that is listen to understand, not to respond or refute. And to put yourself in that curious mindset, almost approaching the conversation as a researcher or an anthropologist, right? So not that you're going to interrogate the person, but that you genuinely want to develop a significantly deeper understanding of what these perspectives are, how they were formed, what is building them, so that you can have that greater, deeper knowledge to then maybe get to a place of connection and perhaps move forward. But that genuine curiosity really can't be faked. And so in order to authentically say to a person, even though we don't agree, I genuinely want to understand this, you have to be able to put on that hat. And the way I do this is to think of myself as a researcher. And that allows me to essentially focus on something other than my own whirlwind of thoughts or objections to, mm-hmm. to what someone might be saying.
Colonel Bree Fram and Dr. Liz Cavallaro, authors of Forging Queer Leaders, How the LGBTQIA+ Community Creates Impact from Adversity. Thank you again for joining me on The Facing Project.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much.
Forging Queer Leaders, How the LGBTQIA+ Community Creates Impact from Adversity is out now everywhere books are borrowed and sold. More about Colonel Bree Fram and Dr. Liz Cavallaro and their work can be found at forgedinfire.org. Many thanks once again to Colonel Bree Fram and Dr. Liz Cavallaro for joining me on today's show, and to their publisher, Jessica Kingsley, for providing a complimentary copy of Forging Queer Leaders, How the LGBTQIA+ Community Creates Impact from Adversity. To listen to past episodes of this program, visit indianapublicradio.org/thefacingproject, or find us on your favorite podcasting app, or through the NPR network, or just ask your smart speaker to play The Facing Project on NPR. To continue the conversation about this episode, find us on Facebook and Instagram at Facing Project. The Facing Project is recorded at Indiana Public Radio at Ball State University in beautiful and wonderful Muncie, Indiana, and is produced by the amazing producer and audio engineer extraordinaire, Sean Ashcraft. The show is distributed nationally through PRX. I'm your host, J.R. Jameson. And until next time, I wish you the courage to share your own story and the empathy to listen to others.